Welcome to The Thing About Austen, a podcast about Jane Austen's world. I'm Zan.
And I'm Diane. And this episode, we're talking about shoe roses for the Netherfield Ball. So the Netherfield Ball is finally happening, and the Bennet household is excited. I mean, I think we're all excited. We are ready for this moment.
Yes.
The weather has been less than hospitable, so the sisters have been trapped indoors, and this has been particularly rough for the younger of the Bennet sisters. Fortunately, they have the upcoming ball to keep them somewhat occupied.
So this is from the text. If there had not been a Netherfield ball to prepare for and talk of, the younger Miss Bennets would have been in a pitiable state at this time. For, from the day of the invitation to the day of the ball, there was such a succession of rain as prevented their walking to Meryton once. No aunt, no officers, no news could be sought after. The very shoe roses for Netherfield were got by proxy. I mean, you know things are desperate when we have no officers.
Mm-hmm. Just trapped at home, staring out the window, watching the rain slide down the panes while sad music plays in the background.
Yes, it does put a damper on the things for these ladies.
So shoe roses were essentially rosettes made of ribbon or lace that would decorate the top of one's shoes. They were particularly popular in the 1600s and were most visibly worn by men, though they also appeared in women's fashions.
The rise of the shoe rose coincided with the rise of a new style in shoes, with the tongues and side pieces that called for latchets or straps and a colored shoestring to secure the shoe, right? This is got to tie it all together. And then the shoe roses were used to cover that functional tying of the shoe. You know, we can't have any function showing.
No, only prettiness. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I appreciate this. According to Frederick William Fairhold in his book, Costume in England, while shoe roses were fashionable at the court of Elizabeth I, apparently James I was concerned about the whole look and asked of shoe roses, quote, if they would make him a rough-footed dove.
Giving some side eye to those roses.
He's like, I don't know if this is for me. I'm not so sure about this.
But, you know, the court was pretty into it and they were really fancy. And so Henry Peacham in 1638 spoke of the exorbitant cost of these new accessories. And he said, some types that go under the name of roses, from 30 shillings to 2, 3, and 4 pounds the pair. Yes, a gallant of the time not long since paid 30 pounds for a pair. That's bananas pricing.
That is a lot of money. And according to Bill Severn in If the Shoe Fits, quote, a middle-class man might spend a week's income for a pair of shoe roses, while those worn by a wealthy noble could equal an average family's earnings for an entire year.
Yeah, so these really extravagant shoe roses would be made of materials like intricate lace made of gold or silver metallic threads, and they might even be like jewel encrusted. For example, according to the book Fashion, Costume, and Culture, Clothing, Headwear, Body Decorations, and Footwear Through the Ages, one noted English trendsetter, Richard Sackville, the 3rd Earl of Dorset, who spent his fortune almost entirely on clothes, counted his shoe roses as separate, special items in his wardrobe and took special pride in his shoe roses made of gold lace.
As you should, as one would.
They get their own closet. The shoe roses get their own closet.
These roses could also be massive, spanning something like 5 inches. So, you know, you've really got the blue ribbon at the fair. You're standing there with your giant rosette. This means these roses were often wider than the shoe. And if you want these fancy shoe roses to last, that means you probably have to adjust the way you walk. According to Pat Earnshaw's article, Lace for Your Shoes, The Impractical Vanity, quote, shoe roses must have been impractical, converting a casual stroll into an awkward strut with the legs straddled so that ankles and silk stockings alike were safe from the slash of their sharp edges.
It's like we can't let these things get anywhere near the silk stockings. We can't let them get anywhere. Like, so you would have a very wide-legged strut.
They're sort of like walking as if they're riding a horse, but there's no horse.
Yes. And doing it very elegantly, I'm sure. Or better yet, you didn't have to adjust your gait at all. Earnshaw continues with, quote, "What the rosettes indicated was that the wearer had no need even to walk. He had a horse, a carriage, or some other conveyance in which servants could carry him."
Obviously, Mr. Knightley, with his lack of carriage usage, is not a man with giant rosettes on his shoes.
Clearly. Yeah. I mean,
clearly not.
He's not even worried about dust. You know, it's he doesn't understand. He just doesn't get it.
So these extravagant shoe roses also get referenced quite a bit in literature, and particularly plays of this era. Our personal favorite reference comes from a play by John Webster called The White Devil. And the reference goes, "Why, 'tis the devil. I know him by a great rose he wears on his shoe to hide his cloven foot." A pretty good reason if ever I
right,
heard one.
Right, yeah.
And we say personal favorite partially because we both worked on an pretty intense project involving that play in graduate school. So, you know, oh, memories.
So many, many memories.
But also because it's just such a specific reason for adorning your shoe with a shoe rose.
Right. You have to hide your cloven foot. Like, you just have to, right? As we mentioned earlier, these shoe roses were primarily worn by men during this era, but we do have examples of women wearing them as well. According to Pat Poppy's article, "The clothing accessory choices of Rachel, Countess of Bath, and other mid-17th century women," the Countess bought a number of shoe roses. In 1643, there is, quote, "For a pair of roses and 3 yards of pink-colored ribbon for your ladyship, bought at Mr. Grumbleton's, 5 shillings 6 pence.
Mr. Grumbleton's is, that's from a Dickens novel?
That is right out of a Dickens novel.
Poppy goes on to point out that, quote, "The pink-colored ribbon that accompanied Rachel's roses might have been for gartering. It was not unknown for some to match their shoe roses to their stockings and their garters."
I mean, obviously.
Come on, like, why not?
Obviously. Yeah.
You're putting this much effort, you might as well.
Well, and there was actually record of the men doing this as well. Like that, I mean, because with women's clothing, you wouldn't see the garters matching. I mean, that's just more for you, right?
Or a special friend.
Or a special friend, absolutely. But for the men, they also would have the matching garter ribbons, and then they would potentially have an additional shoe rose on the outside of their garters at their knees. And so there's just a big fluff at your kneecaps. Mm-hmm. So the truly over-the-top shoe roses largely go out of fashion by the end of the 17th century. However, the decoration continues mostly in women's footwear, and it's generally more subtle. It's a little bit more like kind of a ribbon rosette as we kind of progress in the timeline.
Nothing that requires special walking anymore. At the end of the 18th century, women's shoes were often more like the low-heeled or flat slipper that no longer really relied on the tongue and laces. This is more in line with our idea of the ballet flat. According to the Handbook of English Costume in the 18th century, women's shoes in the 1790s were, quote, "thin and open, mostly in the slipper style, with pointed toes, and were usually trimmed with roses or ribbon ruching."
So the pointed toe, flat-heeled, narrow slipper remains the trend until around 1807, when the toes become a little more rounded. And according to the Handbook of English Costume in the 19th century, evening shoes with rosettes were common until 1819.
So now we're squarely in the Regency era, and women's shoes during this era had a fairly high turnover rate. And according to Hilary Davidson in Dress in the Age of Jane Austen, quote, "shoes were Regency consumables, constantly entering and departing the wardrobe, their lives eked out by frequent cobbling and repairs."
I love the phrasing of that. Their lives were eked out. Like the life of a shoe slipper.
You gotta squeeze as much out of it as you possibly can.
Truly. And dance slippers were perhaps the most obvious example of this kind of what can we get out of the life of the shoe. Davidson goes on to explain that, quote, "ladies' delicate fabric dancing slippers could disintegrate in an evening. A pair of Harriet Wynn's split at a ball. Leather soles wore out fast, no matter how well made, and required frequent replacement."
Davidson gives another example of this delicate attire when she writes, "dancing took its toll on delicate evening attire, as Susan Sibbald found when she danced so much one night that she wore a hole in the sole of her shoe that made her foot bleed. So giving like a lot of fairy tale vibes.
Yes,
here.
Absolutely. Like, you know, by midnight, good luck with that shoe, mm-hmm. right? And these dancing slippers likely only had this one evening, maybe two, worth of use. Like you really had to ration out your use of dancing slippers. So they were so delicate that it was actually fairly common practice for people to bring their dancing slippers to the ball in shoe bags and then only put them on once they have arrived and are inside. They're like, okay, now we can put the slipper on.
I mean, I have done that many a time where it's like I'm wearing my boots or my outdoor shoes to the
yes.
office and I have my indoor heels or flats
yes.
or whatever it is I'm wearing inside that I'm
mm-hmm.
going to change into.
Absolutely. Been there for sure.
So the footwear for a ball was no small consideration. And this includes the shoe roses that would likely be attached to the slippers at the event. Davidson points out that planning for how to make the most of one's wardrobe during a ball, and especially how to get the most wear out of items, quote, occupied women's thoughts for many days beforehand.
And that is definitely what we see happening in this scene in Pride and Prejudice. As we read at the top of the episode, quote, if there had not been another field ball to prepare for and talk of, the younger Miss Bennets would have been in a pitiable state. Like, can you imagine if they didn't have this ball to entertain them, right? And then just a few sentences later, Austin writes, nothing less than a dance on Tuesday could have made such a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday endurable to Kitty and Lydia. It's, you know, 5 days between that invitation to the ball and the event. And, you know, these Bennet sisters, they've got to plan. And obviously, Lydia and Kitty take that time pretty seriously.
So speaking of obtaining the shoe roses, what's interesting about the mention of the shoe roses in this passage is all the subtext that surrounds it. The sentence is, the very shoe roses for Netherfield were got by proxy. Like, we couldn't even go out and get our shoe roses. And the implication being that the Bennet sisters are getting a little bit restless while shut in by the rain, and that shopping would have been an important part of their preparation for the ball. But they can't do that, so they have someone else, so someone by proxy, such as a servant, bring them the shoe roses. It's okay for your servant to go out in the rain, but
right.
we are staying inside.
Exactly. And so Beth Kowaleski Wallace writes about this scene in greater detail in her article, Traveling Shoe Roses, The Geography of Things in Austin's Works. So Wallace writes, someone else must go to Meryton and obtain the shoe roses. Perhaps the maid or some other waterproof being will be sent, or perhaps they will come by post. The striking thing about the sentence is its use of the passive voice. Whoever does the action of getting the shoe roses is effectively erased from the sentence and from the reader's consciousness. What's important is that the Bennet daughters are protected from the foul weather, though someone else is not.
It's fine to send a servant because obviously they are waterproof
yes.
beings. Not an issue for them at all. But a lady to go into the rain?
Only if it's in the pursuit of Mr. Bingley.
Uh-huh. So by examining the structure of the sentence, we're able to get a pretty intricate picture of the labor and class structure that supports the Bennet's family privilege. There are a lot of people who are doing a lot of unseen and unacknowledged work to make those shoe roses appear at Longbourn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As if by magic. They just, you know, the proxy makes them appear. And yeah. Yeah, it also, this section also tells us a bit about the Bennet's consumer habits. We know that the girls are competent at needlework. And we see examples of this throughout the novel, including discussions of making over bonnets and other accessories. We even have an episode on Lizzie's needlework. But notably, the Bennet women do not make their own shoe roses. And this might be because it's really intricate work that's beyond them, but more likely, it's an indicator of just like, this is a luxury and the Bennets have enough money to afford that luxury just being delivered to them.
Wallace also writes, what's being captured here is not just a statement about ball preparations, weather, and shoe roses, but an entire way of thinking. Whoever utters or thinks such a sentence lives in a world where servants are invisible and where the question of their comfort and safety is of no concern, at least not in this instance. Just somebody will take care of that for me.
Yeah.
I don't need to worry about that.
Yeah. Well, I think in this instance, again, because it's shoe roses, which are not an essential piece of the wardrobe, it does add this level of frivolity to the wardrobe and then also kind of makes this moment of, you know, proxy shopping. It makes all of this feel extra luxurious and superfluous. Like, I think it's layering on that idea of, you know, the shoe roses are a fun accessory, but it doesn't negate the fact that someone actually has to make them and deliver them and walk through the rain.
Yeah, because they are, you know, ladies, and they need to, the women need to be protected from the rain, kept indoors.
Right.
So
yeah.
we've got this hardy youth. He can do it for us.
Because he's waterproof, obviously.
He's waterproof, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's such a fun detail. I mean, like, because it is fun to think about shoe roses as a really fun accessory. Because I mean, we all accessorize for fun events. It's harmless in that particular regard. But there is something about the materiality and how does this object arrive to us that Austin embeds here. It's just such a subtle little moment, but it is so articulate of the time.
So this scene, at least as far as we know, and please let us know if we missed one, because we definitely want to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Does not show up in any film adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
Shoe roses do make an appearance in a book adaptation, however. So Jo Baker's novel, Longbourn, is a retelling in which the protagonist, Sarah, is a housemaid for the Bennets. There's an entire chapter where the Bennets discuss the accessories, and then they ask Sarah to venture out in the rain to shop for them because, you know, she's waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
So
a waterproof being.
Turns out she isn't, so she gets soaked and she's dripping wet in the shop while she's making the selection for the girls' shoe roses, and is understandably a little bit grumpy about being sent down on this errand in the mud and the rain. So it's an effective and interesting reimagining of this brief line in Austin's novel that we understand better now than, you know, if we were just reading it the first time. We're no longer going to be taking it for granted, basically.
And it totally makes sense to include that in a retelling that is told from the viewpoint of one of the maids in the household.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And in terms of the actual usage of a shoe rose, we have to point out the connection to our modern usage of clothing and how people are always wanting to take an item of clothing they already have and change it up a little bit. You know, you alter it, you add a belt to this dress, you change out the laces on your shoes, you shorten a hem,
yeah.
You add a scarf. Like, that's something that people have been doing with clothes for forever.
Yeah.
It's such a normal, everyday way of interacting with the objects we put on our bodies.
Mm-hmm. There's also this kind of element of, we know that the dancing slippers are super fragile. And so, like, if you're trying to get extra wear out of them, if you put a shoe rose on the top, there's potential, maybe, to be able to cover up some of the scuffs or something mm-hmm. like that. Maybe you can get just one more wear if you have something like this. Just possibly.
Well, if you have any thoughts on shoe roses, dancing slippers, anything like that, you can contact us via our Instagram at TheThingAboutAustin and on Twitter at Austin_things. You can also check out our website, thethingaboutaustin.com, and you can find our merch for the podcast on Redbubble. Go to aboutaustin.redbubble.com. And you can always email us at thethingaboutaustin@gmail.com. And we have a little bit of listener mail to share this week. So this is from listener Yvette. Before my husband and I were dating, we were friends in school, college. After lunch one day, we walked out to pouring rain. I didn't have an umbrella and had a hike across campus. Next thing I know, my future husband dashed off to the bookstore across the quad. He told me to wait. I did, and he came back with an umbrella. We Yay! Are celebrating our 24th wedding anniversary this year. I still have the umbrella.
Umbrellas are romantic.
How cute is that?
Wow. That is amazing.
Yvette's husband, a modern day Captain Wentworth, just going out to fetch that umbrella. So we love it.
1000%. Mm-hmm. Yes. We love that. That is so good. So, so cute. Stay tuned for next episode when we'll be talking about Henry Crawford reading Shakespeare.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.